Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the KE Report Weekend Show. Shad and Corey here, your host for this weekend show. First half of the show, we're going to be focusing on the metals sector, investing in a wide range of metals, including looking at what the large companies are doing and filtering down to development stage projects, and probably also touching on exploration projects, what you should be focusing on. Back end of the show, we're switching our focus to the energy sector, more oil and natural gas, as those markets have been quite strong and those stocks have been responding to the nice bump in prices that we've seen over the last month, at least for the oil price. We are kicking off the show with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. To visit Joe's website, click on our website or visit our podcast. Just search the KE Report. Listen to the weekend show and find that link in the show notes. Joe, let's start off at the top of the food chain with the majors. The majors, it seems like, continue to build up cash positions. They are investing a little bit down the food chain, but as much as I hear about how the resource investors are waiting for generalists to enter the space, I keep on looking at the majors. They need to lead that charge and draw in some of these other investors because, well, they're at the top of the food chain. That's where investors come into the sector first. They don't bother going down into smaller companies. They look at the market leaders. Joe, in your eyes, what are the majors doing that can help out the overall sector and actually draw in some other investors?
Thanks, Corey. Well, I would say, like, depending which sector we're talking about, commodity gold, let's say, versus copper, gold and silver versus copper. If we look at gold, one of the overhangs for M&A of projects was the Newmont divestments that they did, which they managed to get about several billion out of. You know, as they were merging with Newcrest, they were reprioritizing assets and they divested a lot. So there was a bunch of companies who were interested in acquiring or M&A transactions that weren't buying juniors or single asset developers, but they were looking more at a producing asset that would come out of Newmont. That's gone. So now the next layer of growth potentially for these guys, especially the intermediates, would be like those single asset developers that are still, in terms of valuation, relatively cheap, some very cheap. And then one part of that is because retail, that like gold, they don't like development stories, they like exploration stories. And so once they get into that, let's say the valley of death in terms of development, the retail has left. And so there's not much liquidity. Their shares don't move. And so it's a great opportunity for a producer that can show growth to acquire. Problematically, there's some of these that have been acquired, the cheap buying the company, but not cheap building the asset. And you can ask B2 Gold about, you know, Sabina and building the Goose project. So, you know, I think companies will be looking at not only permitting, how long will it take to permit, but also checking those capital numbers to say that they're happy about that. Water access will be important. So all those things is what a single asset developer will have to get checked with respect to attracting suitors in terms of the development stage. In terms of exploration, I see more on the copper side where I see majors going upstream and leveraging off junior companies' expertise in a jurisdiction or a style of deposit that they don't have potentially, because a lot of the experience in that has gone to the juniors as the older, more experienced people in big companies retire and then they start doing something else and they end up in a junior company. So it's not like the major always has more of the intellectual property. Sometimes the junior does. And jurisdictionally they could as well, because they could be in a place for a long time. So I see companies like tech doing a lot of these private placements. We saw this, and they could be private placements or or also project earn-ins. So dilution either in the numerator on the project or the denominator with respect to equity, and sometimes both. But given their cost of capital to go to the equity markets to raise the kind of capital that they would need to do a decent exploration program, it's cheaper to get the money from industry. And I see that trend continuing into 2025.
Well, Joe, let's dive into that even a little bit further. You brought up a great point off mic before we started recording today about kind of the differences that you see when the larger companies really do an earn-in at the project level versus just coming in at the equity level and the different ways you view that.
Yeah, I mean the problem with like most retail, probably more so in the buoyant markets, would not want to see project dilution. They want a company to own 100% of that asset as long as they can until they can get taken out, let's say. But problematically, especially with the copper projects that require a lot of money to drill, juniors can't maintain that spend, and it's constantly dilutive. And so it's better to get that commitment from a major to earn into the project. So if you don't hit that great hole that drives your share price and doubles it so you can go back to the markets and raise money, but it's an encouraging hole, the major that's earning into the project will still be encouraged and continue to earn in, whereas the retail market will not, because they're just looking at the grade numbers. They're not checking the alteration, they're not checking the vein density, they're not checking all these other things that would still make a geologist or the exploration team of a major still excited about a project. And so those sort of earn-ins, even though you might dilute to 30%, that's a lot more reasonable than diluting your share structure by five times or plus over an extended period of time to explore this well. And I think the belle of the ball, the Aurora discovery with A-Mark, with those results coming out in early January before the BREIT conference, the MIF, the Metals Investment Forum, and also AME, showed that even if you're diluting at the project level and not the equity level, you could still generate a big return. I mean, that share price went up two or three times based on those intersections that they got out of the Aurora project, which was a prospect that they have in a joint venture earn-in with Freeport.
So if you like these earn-ins better than equity investments, are there any red flags when you see some of these earn-in agreements that do worry you a little bit? Because there can be a lot of moving parts when it comes to some of these earn-ins.
Yeah, my problem on the earn-ins is about the flow of news. Some companies get real, let's say, anally retentive about news flow and then control how the news is put out such that the junior does not have a lot of leeway in terms of distributing the news. And sometimes it'll only come out at the end of a quarter, even though, the news happened like maybe a couple of months ago, because the big company will say, oh, that's not material to us, so I'm not going to put it out. And then, but the for the, to the junior, that it is very material. And so you definitely need a strong management team that will insist, and a strong project that would insist that, okay, if I have news, it's material to me, we're putting out. You get to look at the news release, but you can't stop it. And that's very important. So if you're invested in the junior, news flow and catalysts are very important. But if there's any restriction on the news flow by the major, that's obviously a red flag.
Well, Joe, just thinking about how some of this eventually translates over to M&A deals and takeovers, which is what a lot of investors want to see. Is it possible that people are spending so much time obsessing on what Newmont or Barrick are going to buy that they're missing the fact that most of the takeovers we've seen in the last couple of years have actually been the mid-tiers taking over development projects or single asset producers? I mean, yeah, we did see Agnico take over O3 recently, and we did see Gold Fields take over Osisko Mining, but you brought up B2 Gold and Sabina. I was thinking of Aura taking over Bluestone or Orla taking over Gold Standard Ventures, First Majestic taking over Gatos, Silvercorp taking over Adventus. I mean, there's a lot of mid-tiers doing a lot of action. Should people maybe hone in on what some of the mid-tiers want?
I am more almost focused on the mid-tiers because the acquisition of a single asset developer would have more of an impact on their growth than a major. So majors are right now are seemingly more interesting in merging with another major, whereas the intermediates can still show incremental growth by acquiring a single asset developer and taking a leg up. And you know, and given the valuations, if potentially if it's the right project, correct infrastructure, jurisdiction, it could still be very to the intermediate. And now given, you know, where we're sitting with respect to the cost of capital for a single asset developer, if you get an intermediate with a portfolio of assets and cash flowing and a decent balance sheet, their cost of capital will be much lower. So, you know, who can build the project? That's really not a choice. You definitely go for the company that's intermediate. And so you, as a shareholder in the junior, would be willing to take shares of the intermediate because it's an exit for you, but also you could maintain leverage to the asset if you think it's, you know, a really good asset. And then also you would still see growth in the intermediate. Whereas in a bigger company, you might not even see the impact of that asset in that company's portfolio.
Yeah, that's so true. But that's also because these large companies are just so much bigger than the rest of these other, I guess, developers and also smaller scale producers. Are there any companies in mind that you have of these mid-tiers that you see as building out a nice pipeline that I guess could eventually make the jump into being considered a bit more of a major, or even more importantly, to your point, have the ability to fund expensive project builds?
Yeah, I mean, one that stands out probably in terms of, you know, a company that would be looking to acquire, like I would be looking at, you know, growth profile and sometimes jurisdictional risk. You know, what drives a suitor to acquire might be different. You know, you might be thinking growth when they might be thinking diversification. You know, and or they might be thinking about not only diversification of having another cash flowing asset, but also away from where their focus is. So a lot of the geopolitical risk that's escalating, creeping nationalism in parts of West Africa may force the Endeavor Minings and some other companies that are overexposed to that area to acquire outside of that jurisdiction. So you might not even be thinking about them, but suddenly they might be acquiring something outside of their so-called backyard. So, and a company with a, you know, decent treasury that's looking for growth, like Kumtor with Centerra Gold, you know, that project was taken away from them. They settled and they ended up with a big treasury. So in terms of, you know, they're set up to look for a new acquisition. So, you know, that's another company that's probably on the precipice of doing some kind of M&A transaction. And they'll probably look for something lower risk jurisdiction than try to go back to someplace in Central Asia like Kyrgyzstan again, or the Kyrgyz Republic. I can't remember which one it was. But yeah, so what the majors, there's less super majors, obviously. And again, I think that they're more interested in acquiring other producers and merging and lowering their costs by cutting G&A, whereas the intermediates would exactly be what I would be looking for with respect to acquisition of single asset developers.
Well, and Joe, to the point you just made about diversification, we saw some deals where, you know, Mako was in Nicaragua, but they decided to go into Guyana to be part of that Guyana shield by buying Gold Source. Or you saw G Mining that already had a mine built in Brazil also switched to Guyana to, you know, diversify. Silvercorp getting out of China, going in with Adventus to Ecuador. So we've seen some of that. But what about the ones where something like Magino, that was a problem for Argonaut, but Alamos is a large mid-tier, and they came in because they thought the synergies with their Island Gold Mine with the mill and not having to build a new mill and the tailings were the go, or Coeur buying Silver Crest to fix their balance sheet. So couldn't there even be some other angles as far as some of these M&A deals?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, even with First Majestic getting Gatto, you know, just to increase their silver production because, and potentially their cash flow as you know, they've been basically saddled by their own devices with the Jerritt Canyon asset in Nevada. So yeah, every company is a bit different in terms of there's no single sort of silver bullet that says, oh, this is why everybody's going to be looking. But all we can do is look for the assets that we think make sense to be taken over. If an asset's got a red flag, the probability that would be taken over from any potential suitor with any sort of driver for the acquisition, where whatever it is, but if it's got a red flag, it won't be acquired by any of them. So the asset definitely has to be, check all the boxes for any kind of style of acquisition, whether it's diversification, whether it's growth, whether it's improving the balance sheet, whatever it is, it's still got to be an asset that makes sense. And then also, depending on the suitor, let's say they're not good at underground mining and they usually do open pit heap leach, then the question is, can they do these other projects? Or the one that only does underground, can they do a big bulk tonnage open pit? Those are the other sort of things that the suitor would have to, get comfortable with in terms of taking a new asset on. So companies that do have a comparative advantage in a size deposit, a scale deposit, they might want to stick to their knitting, while others, when they're making the acquisition, maybe they're not only acquiring the asset, they're acquiring the people that understand how to develop that asset.
What about land consolidations when it comes into M&A in these areas that have what seem to be a lot of good projects, but a lot of juniors there? I'm thinking Golden Triangle, and especially now in the Yukon with the Tombstone Gold Belt. Do you see any land consolidation plays coming, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, there's always potential for, expanding. What I see is, in terms of expanding land packages, what I see more of is where there's companies with assets, with plants, with tailings facilities that are running out of ore. And those that are running out of ore will look to juniors that you might not think are big enough, you might not think make much sense, but they have the ore to keep the plant running such that they don't have to start, reclaiming that asset. And so that's another, trend potentially for acquisitions, because people do not want to shut down these, plants that have been going for such a long time. And also take advantage of the fact that, if they had to permit a new facility, it would take whatever, 5 to 10 years in some jurisdictions.
Joe, what do you think about the trend of some of the juniors that are developers deciding to team up and put two development projects into the same company? I'm thinking of things like NexGold, where you combined Signal and Treasury together, or something like Stellar, where they combined Nighthawk and Monarch together. Do you like that idea of two development companies massing up in size?
Well, I mean, all it's the problem with that is that, if retail doesn't like development, they like two development assets even less. But it does allow, you to, it's mostly for me, the big advantage would be the institutional or high net worth shareholder that owns both companies and does not want to pay 2x G&A. He would rather consolidate the management, cut the G&A, and have management decide which of the two assets they want to focus in on. That's really the person that does well out of those transactions.
Yeah, sure seems to be. We are seeing a consolidation of companies, which I think is good, but again, we need these assets built. But Joe, do you see a major move towards building more mines, and building them profitably is a whole other conversation, but do you think that this year, next year, the next couple of years, let's say, all of a sudden capital frees up and companies are able to build these assets?
Okay, so it depends on the commodity. So for gold, the way gold price has gone, there will probably be more people interested in developing gold projects that make sense. And silver, the way Mexico is going, I think there are people that are, very willing to develop silver-rich assets. Copper, more difficult because the copper price hasn't done what the gold price has done. And so, and then all we've had is escalating capital costs. So the capital intensity of copper's gone up, but the price hasn't matched it. So most copper companies, don't believe the incentive price is there for them to build big projects. But saying that, Arizona Sonora, which I have shares in, we've had for a while, they got a private placement from HUD Bay. And so HUD Bay is also building a project in Arizona called Copper World, which is basically the phase one of the project that got stalled there. But it's all on private land, much like Arizona Sonora's Cactus Parcellia project. And so those are the projects that you probably could build because they're smaller, mostly open pit, and they produce cathode. They're not going to a smelter. And so depending on the project, yeah, I could see some copper projects being built. But the big projects, the size of a Quebrada Blanca too, I'm hard pressed to think of a company willing to take that chance at this copper price.
Yeah, I don't see any huge copper projects on the radar, but if we think about gold, Joe, when we look back to last year, it actually was a big year for projects getting built. I mean, Côté got built, Greenstone got built, Magino got built, Ascot's Premier mine got built, but there was hair on all those deals where they took longer, they cost more. Do you think that has people?
I don't think Ascot's got built. I don't think that's commercial.
Yeah, it struggled a little bit as far as getting off the ground. I'm just saying, as far as big mines in Canada, we saw a lot built, and even Greenstone got their mine built in Brazil. So, do you think, though, some of those having those challenges of cost overruns and longer time frames has other companies hesitating?
Well, the ones in Canada that you mentioned, they obviously took a while to build and they actually cost more than they wanted them to cost, and they changed the scope and they went through some management changes as well. And yeah, so and Argonaut with Magino ended up getting acquired by Alamos, and like you said, that was more for the tailings capacity than for, the asset to build that open pit project that they were looking at. So, yeah, I would say that the gold projects that are going to get built, and then also if we take the fact that West Africa, some West African countries like Burkina Faso and Mali have gotten all the more risky, and people are worried about contagion into other places, not only for security risks, but also increasing free carry, increasing royalties, such that some of these deposits may not make much sense in terms of getting a quick payback in a, risky jurisdiction, let's just say. That might force people to other places where they say, oh, maybe under the current US administration, permitting in the States will be easier, will be quicker than it was before. So maybe I'll go back there. So that's a lot of the movements that we shall see, because governments are changing. Argentina's looked very well. I was down there three times last year. Every province there is different, and the province controls the resources. So the good provinces now with the new federal government have gotten all that much better because now the federal government's not an impediment to development. Chile, in another year or so, the left-wing government there is going to be gone, and people are getting themselves set up for that. Peru, the current president there, she's very unpopular, but they're working through a backlog of permitting. And with what's happening in Mexico, some of the silver guys are going down back to Peru to look for silver projects.
One thing that we keep hearing about with all this permitting and companies saying, oh, we think that we might be able to get our permits faster because we have a critical mineral within our project. Man, oh man, we're hearing a lot about antimony recently. Joe, is this just marketing or do you see any critical minerals designation actually speeding up the process and even making capital a bit cheaper?
Well, I mean, if we go back, I mean, a project like Thacker Pass, I don't think in any normal cycle for any commodity would ever get built, given its capital intensity. But Ford came in with money, and also, I believe it was the Department of Energy or Defense, I can't remember which. And so if people are actually willing to lend the people money, then it's real. But they can't change the lithium price, in terms of how it makes money. But I don't think under the current US administration, we're going to see that kind of money going to critical minerals. But we possibly will continue to see that kind of money going to, let's say, security minerals, which is more of the focus. And those are the metals and commodities that are getting export bans in China, like antimony, like some rare earth elements. And those are the ones that, that you are concerned about from a supply chain perspective. So the Perpetuas with their Stibnite project, that's, I don't know how much it is now in terms of life of mine revenue, but it's not, I don't think it exceeds 10%. It might be 5 to 10%, but with that export import bank, I mean, they potentially could get all of their upfront capital from them. I doubt if they're going to get it all, but still, I mean, they need apparently 1.2 billion, but the line of letter of intent with respect to the upfront money they're willing to dole out is almost 1.6, 1.8. So I think that will continue. But the problem is a lot of this debt, or let's say low cost of capital for some of these critical minerals, is not going to change, let's say the lithium price or the cobalt price or whatever. Going forward under the incoming administration, I think most of that low cost of capital debt will go to the security minerals. What's nice for Perpetua and these kind of companies is the gold price is doing very well. So the majority of their revenue is pinned to a commodity that's doing quite well. But what antimony is doing is lowering their cost of capital. And that's what is happening. It's not a figment of anybody's imaginations. That's the reality. But it's a good thing in the sense that they're making their money off of precious, but the way they're getting their money in is with the antimony.
Well, Joe, we had talked about Perpetua and the Stibnite project and how long it took to actually get from the beginning stages to where it is today. I think it's over a dozen years, maybe upwards of 14 years, just to get to this point where they got their final permits. Do investors need to think about that? Because when you think about copper, it's even worse how long it takes to get a mine built and constructed. Do people need to adjust their time frames?
Well, yes. I mean, let's be honest about this. It's like exploration cycles and retail investment cycles are very different. They want that hit quickly, whereas as we know that, exploration could be 3 to 5 years, almost a decade. Like if you take AMARC with their project, that's about how long that took to realize this kind of return. The thing about the S&P Global Market Intelligence did like an average, and it was like 15 to 20 years from discovery to commercial production for a lot of these projects. And I when I was down in Peru, I took a look at one, which was Quellaveco, a big copper gold porphyry in Peru that's being built by Anglo American. It was acquired in the early 90s, and it went into commercial production just a couple of years ago. So that's almost a 30-year timeline for this big footprint porphyry copper gold project. And it's not just permitting, not just social license, not just water issues, but it's, companies changing priorities, commodity prices, the cycle of the commodity prices. So all that, goes into how a project's built. And because we think that it's a little bit like tunnel vision, like, okay, you made the discovery. Okay, now you do your feasibility study or your scoping study, your PFS, your feasibility study, and then you get your permit. Then it's 3 to 5 years for construction. Okay, that's the timeline. Well, it doesn't work like that. I mean, the averages the S&P Market Intelligence are giving you is some of these are probably low in terms of what the reality is. I mean, look again, I keep bringing back the example for the Resolution project in Arizona. I mean, when I worked as an analyst for Phelps Dodge, we had that project coming in to commercial production in 2010. It's now 2025.
Crazy. Hey, Joe, these things take a while and it's not changing. These things aren't speeding up at any sort of drastic pace. It takes a while from discovery to build, if even an asset gets there. But Joe, let's take a step back then. And I want to hear your just honest assessment of the overall health of this market, because I was actually surprised at the recent conferences, still the number of companies and people saying just how tough this market is. Where, look, the metals prices are doing well, and I've noticed a lot of positive stories out there from the top of the food chain, even down to the explorers. Number of companies doing good work, raising money on the back of that, and share prices moving higher. I realize it's not every stock, but look, in your eyes, What's the overall health of the sector? Is this a bull market? Is this still a very much tough sector for investors? What's your overall assessment of investing in metal stocks?
Well, right now, I think it's still a bit of a stock picker market in terms of the right management teams, the right assets in the right places. There's still I think that's still where we're leaning towards, as opposed to all boats getting lifted right now. That's not the case. Access to capital for a lot of these companies is still difficult, and from what I understand now, for Canadian companies with flow through. Some of those expiration tax credits, those things, which have to be renewed every year, will be more problematic this year because the government is not functioning, I believe, until March. So access to capital might still be an issue for some of these companies. But again, as we've seen, before, is those companies that have a history of success, that have done it before, no matter what the asset they have, they'll constantly attract capital. So what little capital there is, they'll go to these people. And so that link with the people, and it's all about, the right projects, yes, the right people, but the right people are lowering your cost of capital. They're filtering the asset, but they're also lowering your cost of capital because people are willing to give money to these people, whether equity mostly. And then hopefully they can do some of these private placements at not a big premium to their market prices, as well as not have to issue these 5-year warrants at a 20% premium. So those are the sort of people you want to watch. I think that hasn't changed in the current market.
Okay. Joe Mazumdar, again, editor of Exploration Insights. Joe, it's always great having you on the show. I really appreciate just your honest outlook on these markets and on a number of the companies that we touched on too. Look, I very much value your newsletter, so I hope all of you listening click on that link in the show notes to visit the Exploration Insights website and consider signing up for Joe's newsletter. Joe, again, thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.